Hi, and welcome to another episode of Rule of Carnage. This is a video series, a podcast. It's all many wonderful things, on which myself, Glenn Ford, games designer and developer, talks to this splendid chap, Mike Hutchinson, also a games designer and developer, about designing better miniatures games. Now, in one of our previous videos, there was a throwaway comment about the competitive versus narrative oppositional that some games like to sort of, or some people or whatever like to set up as an idea that your game is either competitive or it's narrative. Or a lot of times games say, well, this is a narrative game, it's not a competitive game. I don't think that that's a choice you have to make. I don't think those are two things where you can only have one or the other. I don't think Mike believes that either. I was sort of wondering, well, why is it that that it's suggested that it's one or the other? Why isn't it one or the other? What maybe is a better set of terms there? And I think what I've sort of come to, and we'll sort of beat this out, is that I don't think competitive and narrative are actually like black and white. I don't think they're direct opposites. I think that they're sort of points on a scatter diagram, possibly. I think that the oppositional part to competitive is probably collaborative or something like that, and maybe the opposite of narrative is abstract. Because before coming to the recording, we're sort of saying like, okay, well, a game with no narrative is something like Connect Four. A board game. We all know that has no narrative to it whatsoever. It's a fully abstract game. That is the thing that is opposite to, I think, like a narrative game, an RPG that's like almost all narrative. Now I think part of the issue is that like m no miniatures games are fully abstract, or very, very few, or not many that I've come across. They're inherently trying to be simulationist. Or cinematic or narrative to some degree. And then it's a question like of how much other things you're expecting your players to put aside in service of how narrative you want the game to be, versus how much the narrative can be put aside in favor of crunchy mechanics and the things that are interesting about abstract games, maybe, is more part of what I think people want to say there.
And I think if I've an axe to grind on this, it's that I worry, and in fact I encounter games that end up leaving like opportunity design opportunity on the table because they sort of marked one end of the spectrum as bad. And said, well, I can't do things that are in that end of the spectrum because that would detract from what I'm trying to deliver. And to a degree, it also happens in some communities for some games where you can come at the game with the wrong attitude if you head off in the I would like to play with sort of crunchy, crisp, competitive mindset. That's in some respects treated as an anathema to a certain kind of game. And I think it is an anathema to a certain kind of game, but it isn't an anathema to narrative and storytelling. And so I think that for me, my axe is like, if I'm going to make a game which is deeply interested in theme and flavor, that doesn't mean it can't also be one that delivers a very tightly defined and crunchy to engage with sort of victory system at the same time. In fact, for me, quite often engaging with and trying to explain the core conflict that the players are engaged with in terms of the narrative of the little tiny miniature players on the field is part of like bringing bringing an elaborate improvised narrative together. If they just turn up on the field and you have to entirely collaboratively explain why they're there and explain what they might be up to. In some respects, that's more work and it's freer, but it's also lacking some of the constraints that make improvisation fun. And so I guess that's for me, I want to separate these two, and I'm excited by the idea that you've maybe said, well, they're actually different axes, and you've got an up and down that's competitive versus collaborative, or competitive versus casual. I'm not sure exactly what it is. We can get into that. And then on the other side, there's abstract versus narrative, and you can slide all over the place so that competitive and abstract can be chess, and competitive and narrative can be, you know, like Malifaux.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, so saying there about whether it's competitive versus collaborative or competitive versus casual, we were chatting earlier, and I sort of looked at this at first, and I thought it was competitive versus casual. And the reason that I think that came to me is being that way is that, to me, what competitive sort of means is the degree to which skill can affect the result, and also the degree to which work, learning, practice, mm-hmm. study can increase your skill. And I feel like...
Right, and then I think that, like, the game then sort of, through a number of ways, will either suggest that it is cool to put that work in and play to those sort of raising your skills, whereas some games will say, hey, that's kind of not cool if you really work too hard at being good at this game.
Mm. Because it's like I don't know, a game like Jenga is definitely a casual game, it's definitely a skill-based game, but I'm not sure how much Jenga practice will like pay you back, whereas like Malifaux, which you just mentioned, is definitely a competitive game, and I think a large part of the reason it's a competitive game is that studying, like sitting down and studying that game, will pay you back very right. significantly in your success levels of the game. And that's, to me, I think that's one of the sort of the ways I think of something being competitive. And if it's less competitive, and why I think of it as more casual, is that it's a game that has a bit more sort of randomness to it, or a bit more sort of like throws you into weird situations, and you just got to try and make your best of it.
And right, and so I think that ends up being quite a useful design sort of directional principle to head off in. It's like, if you want a low skill ceiling because you want players to be able to approach the game and be fairly equal footing without anyone being able to get a great skill advantage, then lots of randomness is definitely the way to do that. Like, we are all familiar with games where randomness is the key decider of the outcome, you know, the classic one being Ludo. Like, no one is truly good at Ludo. You just roll the dice and see how many pips you go round. Mm. And so increasing randomness, which in our case quite often means increasing tables of silliness, and, you know, increasing the variance by which actions happen and the spikiness of them and all that kind of stuff, can kind of lean into, from a game's design, a sensation that it sort of doesn't matter if I play this twice or 200 times, it's still just going to be wacky fun, and, you know, not, you know, it's all good fun, and it's not a game for crunchy competitive play.
Yeah, and I think like board games have this sort of Ameritrash Euro oppositional thing, and I think sometimes the reason we sort of maybe jam together ideas of casualness, in the way that I mean the competitive casualness and narrative as being one thing, is because, you know, there's the idea of like a narrative game is one where you can do anything. It's quite sandboxy. There's like 100 different rules. Every time you go into a room, you could jump through the window, you could climb up the rafters, or et cetera, et cetera. There's so many options that you can't like tactically, you know, reel them all in. What you've got to kind of do is walk in, put yourself in your miniature's place in the room, and go, oh, I probably want to like jump out the window and shoot the guy as I'm, you know, going through it. And those games also often have a high level of randomness. It's like, I've been playing Core Space recently a fair bit, and early on in Core Space, I gave up like worrying too hard about how well I did or winning or losing, because that game just goes, yeah, you know, you everyone pick up 5 tokens, go back at the end of the game and see, turn them over and see how many points they're worth. And it's like, oh, turns out we've all picked up 5 tokens and you've got 10 times as much money as me, because the game just went, yeah, your tokens are just worth 10 times as much as
Also,
his.
you got the 6 robots with the miniguns
Yes,
attacking
yeah.
you.
Yeah, people just wandered up and joined your crew while the other person's just utterly failing to get anybody on their team. And it's like, you know, the idea of at the end of a game of Core Space, like, you know, wanting to crow over your victory because of your great skill just seems like weird. It's odd. And the only way you can get fun at the end, well, I feel the only way I get fun at the end of that is then to tell the stories about what happened. Oh, wasn't it mad when my guy's head got laser bolted off from like way across the table and there was nothing I could do about it? That was hilarious, wasn't it great? Rather than going like, how can I improve for next time? You know, where's the puzzle? Where's the, you know, the crunchiness?
That makes me want to basically relabel the competitive collaborative access as just something like skill ceiling or something, where the higher the skill ceiling, the more invitation there is, the more ability there is for a player to get good, and also for a good player to absolutely smash the teeth out of a new player. And then in this other direction, I'm not sure. So just to sort of head off in another place, like one thing that I feel is like one of the tropes of a more narrative system is its freedom for you to be able to kind of do what you want in order to be able to tell the sort of story that you want. And obviously, you know, the key proponent of that is a role-playing game with a very open resolution system where you can literally just say what you want to do and do anything you like. And to a degree, the smaller the opportunity space for the sort of actions that you can do, then the tighter the rule system is likely to be, and the fewer sort of things that you can do. And so your ability to sort of improvise and tell a story are potentially removed. But I think that that's also slightly a false dichotomy, or rather, the design challenge is to me clear, which is, if you want cool story appropriate things to happen, then those are the things that ought to be available as actions in your game. And it's not an infinity of things. Like, it's just that if you're trying to create a sort of narrative play space, then you need to be able to anticipate to a degree what the canonical, what the sort of tropish activities that people are going to want to be able to do in order to progress the story forward. And not every narrative game provides all of that. So, like, I mean, I don't know if I consider Frostgrave a specifically an example of a narrative game, but I think it's one that is played quite lightheartedly and with a low attitude to skill ceiling by a large proportion of its players. Citation needed, but that's my experience. And I think that one of the things that doesn't do is have like a lot of a charisma system or like a speech system. Like there could have been in an RPG like you know, and Joe McCulloch's talked many times about how this is just his sort of D&D light tabletop experience, but there's this whole sort of social element missing from that. So for him, this isn't a narrative space that allows that kind of stuff to go on, and presumably significant numbers of players are totally cool that the narrative space doesn't permit sort of shouting and luring people over and, you know, taunting people and all that kind of stuff, even though it could fit in that narrative space.
I mean, one of my favorite rules that I've seen in a little while, that probably relates to this, is in Mars Code of
Mars
Rules,
Code
which
Aurora-ish.
I played the other day, has a beautiful, beautiful rule, and one that I might well rip off at some point in the future, where
Yeah, I'm
basically,
obsessed with it as well.
what it says to you is, you can here are the like set of rules for the standard things you're going to do. These are things you're going to want to do repeatedly, and they're quite nailed down and clear and tight rules. And it says, okay, incidentally, you can do literally anything you want to. Do anything you want. What you do is you offer the other player, okay, here's what I'm going to try and do. This is what the result will be of me succeeding, and this is the result of what if I fail. Will you hit? That's my bid.
That's my devil's bargain.
What do you reckon? And the other player can basically accept or refuse, and
Yeah,
then
they have full control to either accept or refuse, and you
yeah,
just have to abide by that.
and obviously if they refuse, you can go, okay, well, what happens if I fail is this. And when I
both my legs,
this,
both my legs.
And I think it's a lovely thing. And I think it's a lovely thing because it's a rule that goes like, okay, if you guys want to sit there and have a 5-minute negotiation over like how badly your arm will fly off when you try to dive through this laser grid, crack on with that. If you want to establish like a few essentially at the table rules of, yeah, you can jump off the building all the way to the floor, you know, with these things, and this is the established thing. And then it has a little resolution system for the deal chosen, so that it's a bit sort of random. There's a little bidding thing and some other cleverness to it. And it's a beautiful rule because it's like, it's super narrative. It's entirely tight. It has like flat out, no, the guy just refuses. He refuses. You move on and you keep playing our very sort of crunchy competitive game.
Yeah, no, it's the closest to the top quadrant of like quite narrative and quite competitive that I think we've seen.
But yeah, like I say, what we were saying before is like, I think that Malifaux is an entirely narrative game. I think Malifaux's got tons of narrative in it.
Well, it does a lot of work in the game setup, and it does a lot of work in, you know, its objectives and the way that you interact. And the, you know, one of the other famous thing about Malifaux when it was in its early days, not only does it use cards but not dice, was the first thing people said. The other thing people would say later on in the evening was, they said, oh yeah, and by the way, this is a game where you can get tabled, have all of your models killed, but still win because it's that kind of a system. I get, just returning to this like complexity of play space thing, like Connect Four is super, super abstract. You can only do one thing. Your total options are one. Checkers, also super abstract. Chess, you know, is abstract, but like there's the beginnings of flavor where like horses move in different ways to bishops. and castles move for some reason. But anyway, like, I guess, you know, maybe that axis, and I'm not sure that this is right, but maybe that axis is about the sort of the breadth of player agency for doing kinds of different kinds of things. Because the more things that you can do in a game, the more you are describing the minutiae of a specific situation or a story.
I mean, I think that's sort of a human concern in many ways. I think one of the things is that if I've got multiple options and they're all fully abstract and they're all just fully like game mechanical, and I'm expected to hold on to that fully abstracted set of ideas with a human brain, I think it's just too much weight. And I think the reason,
so we need the story to tie all the mechanics together.
Absolutely. I mean, so when you're saying before about like the way you explain a game, is it's like, if you try and explain even a very simple war game in totally abstract terms, just as an exercise, just sit down and explain it all as object one influences object two, it's mind-blowingly difficult to explain even the simplest game. What you do is you say, well, that guy can shoot that guy at a range of 24 inches. And it's just instantly, okay, right, I fully understand that. And here's how good he is at shooting. And here's how hard that thing is to hit because it's small. And here's the strength of the weapon. And it just clicks instantly in people's brains. Yeah, all of the things I think will happen when somebody shoots somebody happens. You write out like that as a set of abstracts and then go, okay, you've got this abstract object that has these influence distance abilities and it can move through other abstract objects in certain situations. What sort of situations? Well, when it's jumping through a window, it can. All right, okay. But, you know, explain that in abstract terms. It's absolutely crippling. If you take like, you know, any sort of Ameritrash or very narrative-y game and lay out all of the options you've got in any sort of sandbox game as narrative things referencing stats and numbers and objects, I just don't think people would, you just couldn't get through it. You couldn't hold, it's like, it's hard enough to hold all the options in many Ameritrash games in your head anyway, where you're playing a game and things go badly and someone goes, well, why didn't you push the wardrobe in front of the door? I didn't know I could push the wardrobe in front of the door. Oh yeah, it's on page 47. There's a little wardrobe pushing ability. You know, doing that in abstract terms is just.
So yeah, so I agree with all that. So I'm still chipping away at this other axis. So the other potential that it could be is, And I don't know if this is blending the two. Like one thing that is true about games, which is true about players who approach games in a non-competitive way, is that they are looking for an environment, which may or may not be provided by the game, where they can basically work things out as they go along. And they don't necessarily have to look things up. They can just agree at the table, oh, should we do this? And wouldn't it be, yeah, I bet that guy, like, when the wheel falls off, I bet the driver falls out the window. Like, it doesn't matter if there's driver falling out the window rule. It's like, how much is this turning into a collaborative storytelling toy rather than a magic circle with rules?
I think, you know, unfortunately, I think one of the reasons that this oppositional gets my back up is that I feel that it's about a set of negative ideas about other players. I think that sometimes people who say, oh, this is a, what they mean by competitive, people say, oh, it's a narrative game. They mean by competitive, petty and pernickety and you know, oh, over 1 millimeter of movement, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And they, I don't think they mean a competitive rule set, a rule set that's tight and clear. I think they mean a player who's going to argue over every millimeter measurement and be petty about rules definitions and those sorts of things. It's like, I remember being I might have mentioned this story before on the channel, but I was at a top table at a Throne of Skulls event, and the guy I was playing, you know, we were playing, and I made a movement, and he said, you know, oh, did you intend that that guy can see that other guy? Yes, I did. He said, well, he can't, you know, but you've got extra movement, so redo it, move him over there, and you know what, wherever he ends up, he can see the guy, because I know you can make it to see the guy, and it doesn't really matter, and that's fine. And that's the way we were playing that game, like at the top end of a tournament, you know, where we ended up in sort of, you know, single figure placements, because you could play it competitively and completely not, you know, because when you're playing, I think, very competitively, it's like a lot of what you're playing can be very abstract, where you can go like, I know that thing can reach that thing. I know the measurements. I know the distances. I know the distances between them. I know you can do it. I know that doing it is just a completely uninteresting, like, form of mechanical engagement. Hmm. Let's just say you did it. Put the marker roughly in the right place. We both know what you meant. Let's just do that. We can, you know, we can start playing without the board eventually. You know, we all know where the pieces are anyway, because we know the game well.
So I had an experience this week, actually, which for me sort of highlighted some of this. Like, and this, I think, is why I'm talking about the magic circle specifically. So I was playing my second game of Elder Scrolls, Call to Arm. And we were playing it's sort of an intro game. Like, it's only my second game. Most of the other people have only played one or two. And there was a very complicated set of objectives in the game. Like, there were five ways we could all score victory points. And every individual player had another one or two ways of scoring victory points. So there were, you know, at least a dozen ways of scoring victory points. So really difficult to keep track of. Like, I was literally writing notes, just sort of, you know, keep my head screwed on. And there was a big scrum in the middle where a lovely narrative sort of main mission was happening, where the guys had an altar in the middle of the table, and they had to walk over to the edge of the board and grab like a city guard, and there was a token that was being represented by a miniature, and sort of yank that guy over by the chain around his legs to like do a ritual sacrifice at the altar. This was, you know, I forget the name of the Skyrim people who are super evil and definitely doing culty activities. And so at the beginning of the game, it wasn't important like what those tokens were, whether they had board presence, how exactly they moved. And then in turn four, it became suddenly and instantly critically important to know, is a token like carried or not carried? And how does an engagement like negate that? Do like, if they have to start fighting with one of my guys, do they drop the guy, or are they like, can they walk away? Like, it suddenly became really, really knotty about how exactly this particular mechanic worked. And in a way, you could just say, well, you know, they're holding the chain and they're fighting with the other hand and like whatever. But the point was, at the moment when they walked up, we'd all assumed the rules worked one way, and so we described the puzzle, and all the players around the table figured the puzzle out. And at the start of the next turn, because the board state had changed, people started making different assumptions about what the models were and what the rules were, and suddenly the puzzle changed. And at that point, I stepped in and went, "Well, wait a minute, you've just changed the rules because I solved a puzzle with this assumption, and now you're telling me that I can't walk away with this when you guys could just walk away with it." And so I started to feel quite gamey because I was like just wanting to understand what the magic circle is, because without understanding what the rules of the game are, I can't engage with it. Like the game just melts away. And it's not me being like, "Oh, I can't win because I don't know what the rules are." It's like, no, that's literally what a game is. And if you take that away, it's just a toy and we're just having fun pushing models around. And that's okay if that's what you want. And perhaps that is part of the difference between people saying, "I don't want to understand the rules because I just want to have a collaborative experience where you and I just sort of play with a toy." And I suddenly felt at this point like, "Oh, wow, I'm being that like mealy mouthed guy that's really trying to figure out, but what do you like? Can I walk inside engagement range? Because if I can, then blah, 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 blah." And it was just me trying to engage with what I was enjoying about this, which was a fun story adventure had turned into a technical puzzle and we were all puzzling it out together. But when the puzzle, if the puzzle was to be dismissed with, "Hey, Mike, don't worry about the rules," then the whole thing melts away and there isn't a magic circle anymore.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's most difficult for me about narrative, as the lead idea over whether the rules matter, is that you can have totally opposing opinions about what should happen narratively in a given moment, utterly honestly and utterly without trying to win and game the thing. Where it's, you're saying, "Oh, well, it's fine to imagine they're holding the chain with one hand and fighting with the other hand." And it's like, "Oh, is that fine? Because it feels like if the guy's being dragged to being sacrificed by a chain and he's dragged, that might unbalance you a little bit when you're fighting. It feels to me narratively like that's a terrible explanation for what's going on." It feels like, you know, and those are two totally reasonable points of view. And what you want, what I always want in the more narrative a game is, for me, the more I want the rules to step in and just go, "Well, it's this. It's the answer to your discussion."
Or as the example we gave, it's like, "Cool, okay, you've both got two opinions. Let's have a crispy way of defining and resolving that." And, sure, you know, just roll a four up is fine, but like it's not brilliant.
Yeah, and I think sometimes, again, like what people mean by, "Oh, it's a competitive rule set," is when it's time to like define crunchy situations, you're gonna have to get out a 100-page rule book and get the rules accountant out and, "Oh well, subsection 14b says da 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 da." And ironically, I find mostly when I consider games I consider to be narrative have much thicker rule books than the ones that I consider to be like more competitive a lot of the time, because the narrative, what my litmus test for narrative games are, can you like climb up something and jump a gap between two buildings? That usually means it's some sort of narrative war game as opposed to a very competitive war game. And usually that means that there's a page on like falling damage and a page on climbing and a page on climbing with ropes and a page on climbing with ladders and going up, you know, balconies and swinging from windows, and it actually has way more rules and sort of requests you to learn more of them a lot of the time than things that are very sort of abstract and competitive and at the other end of that scale. I think, and just one last thing is, like, I think part of my issue is that what I mean by narrative is something sandboxy with like low player control. What I think uncharitably sometimes some people mean by narrative is, I'm allowed to have loopholes and flaws because the right kind of player will ignore them or work around them. And so it doesn't matter that the rule set isn't necessarily complete or clear, because if you're one of my guys, you'll, you know, laugh about it, you know, and over a frothing pint decide what's going to happen rather than me having to do the spade work for you.
I mean, there is definitely a different axis of like how charming and inviting your game experience is, because that will definitely up the threshold of like being irritated by omissions or bugs. Like in video games, that's very much a thing where like a game with a really good premise or a really, really expansive, like shooting for the moon kind of a design, you know, is going to have, like, we're just talking about Skyrim filled with bugs. No one really minds because, you know, they know they had a team that was the size it was and they shot for the moon and they slightly missed in some areas. And it's fine because it's charmed its way past some of its more rocky bits. And so I think that there is, like, you know, just to sort of turn that slightly uncharitable thing around and be like, well, if you are not confident that you can fully deliver against everything that is in your kind of in your vision for the game, which is feasible for a number of reasons, and Bethesda clearly has, you know, some of those reasons, like, maybe it's okay if you also deliver it in a charming way, and then, like, maybe saying, you know, oh, it's a little bit narrative, you're going to have to sort of lean in a little bit, because, you know, a game which tries to, you know, replicate the, you know, all evolved life forms in an entire universe in one skirmish system is going to obviously have a few gaps.
But at the same time, you know, I would say, you know, as one of our points here is, it something like Miles Code Aurora has shown us how to offer that sort of, you know what, I haven't covered all the bases, I haven't given you all the options, what I've given you is this, my Omni rule for allowing you to do literally everything in the world, and it being fair, and it being equitable, and it fitting into a nice little crunchy rule system. So it's doable.
I know, and, you know, we've been hailing its praises, fine. Like, Miles Code Aurora is not a very narrative game. Like, I did not read the rule book and go, like, oh, I understand the universe and all the characters in it and blah, blah, blah. So, like, it's actually sort of, like I said, like, you could wrap it in an even more charming delivery system. Anyway, so I think we don't know exactly what these axes are. I think we are clear that there's not a dichotomy between narrative and competitive. They are interrelated, but they are not the same. Yeah. They are not two points on the same spectrum. And there's a few different ways of attacking this that we've explored. But I suppose, like, if there's game design discussion points, for sure, it's like, what's the space of options that you're providing, and how many of those have unique rules?
Just because you sort of said, you know, Miles Code Aurora is arguably not narrative, I think, contained within itself particularly, but here's what I think is a very nice.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
You've seen Rory's story dice, it's a set of dice with little images on, you roll it, and then you tell a story about what the dice are. Utterly abstract, extremely narrative.
There you go. It
contains no narrative whatsoever in the game, but it's a 100% the narrative game. And on that
breaks the axis.
on that irritatingly axis destroying comment, this might be a conversation we come back to. If it's a conversation you'd like us to come back to, please drop down in the comment section and tell us. I'm not saying we've got answers on this thing. We definitely don't have answers on it, but I definitely think it is considered uncharitably by some people, and these shouldn't be pejorative terms, and they shouldn't be things for, like,
in either direction.
In any direction, you know, everybody is right, and every game, you know, does these things acceptably. You know, try to use them as badges of honor, and don't run a game down by accusing them of any of these terms. If you'd like us to chat more about this, let us know in the comments section. Also, when you're gone in the comments section, to let us know that you enjoyed listening to us chat about it, hit the like and subscribes, and that way we'll know to go on in the future. Swing by the Discord. I mean, this is a chat that can go on, and we'll have it in the Discord until the cows come home. But for now, and from this episode of Rule of Carnage, it'll be a thank you, goodbye. So thank you and goodbye.
Bye-bye. Cheers. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.